Shalom, and welcome to On the House, the podcast where you'll find everything you need to know about purchasing real estate in Israel. Hosted by Debbie Goldfischer, real estate consultant and founder and CEO of buyitinisrael.com. In each episode, Debbie sits down with leading industry experts to explore market trends, legal and tax issues, smart buying strategies, neighborhoods across Israel, and more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move.
Welcome back to another episode of On the House, the Israel Real Estate Podcast, and the season dedicated to making Israel your home. Last week, we had the tremendous privilege of speaking with Rabbi Yehoshua Fass, co-founder of Nefesh B'Nefesh, about the incredible work the organization is doing to bring Jews home. We explored the motivation behind the movement and focused on one of the most pressing challenges facing potential Olim today, the housing crisis. Rabbi Fass shared how Nefesh B'Nefesh is working behind the scenes to help people navigate rising prices and affordability concerns. We also spoke about transplanting communities, partnering with rabbis, and encouraging a shift in mindset, not just to help people make aliyah, but to help them truly thrive here. It was powerful, emotional, and deeply inspiring. And this week, I have to admit, I'm a little nervous, but more than anything, I'm incredibly honored and deeply grateful because we have today a guest who I honestly didn't think would say yes when I reached out, but he did. Not only did he say yes, he said it with kindness, generosity, and humility. Hillel Fuld, and the topic, Why Every Jew Belongs in Israel. I don't think I even need to introduce him. Everyone knows who Hillel is. And if somehow you don't, by the end of this episode, you'll understand why so many people across the globe look to him for clarity, truth, hope, and direction, especially since October 7th. Hillel has taken his skills, his energy, his background in high tech and marketing and poured them into advocacy for Israel and for the Jewish people for morality and truth. Personally, I often feel like Hillel speaking my thoughts, just with more eloquence, more courage, and more clarity. He says the things I feel in my gut, but don't always know how to express. He's not afraid to speak truth, even when it's uncomfortable. He's relentless in his mission and tireless in his efforts. He is, without a doubt, one of the most powerful and consistent voices we have right now. So Hillel, thank you. Thank you for being a light, for using your voice and your platform to inspire, to uplift, and to lead with truth. For giving people hope, whether it's the push they need to make aliyah, find a new job, put on tefillin, reconnect with Shabbat, or become better parents, spouses, children, and friends. Thank you for challenging us to think more deeply, live more courageously, and believe in something greater than ourselves. Last week I mentioned to Rabbi Fass how fitting it is that his name is Yehoshua, the one who led the Jewish people into the land of Israel. And I was thinking, it's no coincidence that your name is Hillel. Hillel the Elder, Hillel HaZaken, one of the greatest sages of Jewish history living in the time of the Second Temple. He was known not only for his Torah knowledge, but for his deep humility and moral clarity. And of course, Hillel means praise. And you, Hillel, bring praise to Hashem through the way you live, the way you speak, the way you uplift the Jewish people. You truly are a walking Kiddush Hashem, the moral voice of a generation. And in so many ways, Hillel Fuld, you carry the same voice today of Hillel HaZaken, courageous, clear, committed to truth, focused on the Jewish people, never afraid to say what needs to be said. And with that, I am truly excited to have this conversation. We're going to talk about hard truths, common fears, personal journeys, and the big question, why every Jew belongs in Israel. But before we get started, there's a personal story that I want to share. Many years ago, I made a shift from marketing into real estate. But even then, I had this bigger idea, something I couldn't fully put into words. I knew I didn't just want to sell apartments. I wanted to help Jews buy homes in Israel in a way that felt informed and supported, because I truly believe that buying a home in Israel isn't just a real estate transaction. It's part of the journey of coming home. The problem was I didn't know how to get started. I wasn't sure how to put myself out there or even what out there really meant. And a mutual friend, Yisrael Spiro, said, you got to speak to Hillel. He's really into this thing called Facebook and Twitter. So we met at Aroma in Beit Shemesh. You gave me a full hour and a half of your time. So generous, so open. I walked away from that meeting feeling overwhelmed, thinking, I don't know if I can really do this. I don't know if I'm cut out to be that public. But one thing you said stuck with me, and it's shaped everything I've done since. Become an expert, pick your lane, own it, and be that person. And that advice gave me clarity. It gave me permission to focus, to go deep, and to build something meaningful. And over time, with that mindset, Buyin in Israel has, thank God, become a trusted voice and resource for people all over the world to learn, to plan, to understand the process, to feel supported, and ultimately, to buy a home in Israel. So, Hillel, let's get into it. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Holy moly. Holy moly. I could just retire now.
You absolutely could. You deserve it.
What an introduction.
I mean every word.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So Hillel, since October 7th, something has shifted for you. You've always been a proud Israeli, deeply connected to Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, but there's a different kind of urgency now. Can you take us back to that moment? What changed for you? How has it shaped the way that you're using your voice today?
So that's a good question. I'd say for the last 15 years, I was really building an audience on social media as a tech guy. It's true that under the surface, I was promoting Israel, but it was through tech. So if someone followed me, they wouldn't feel like I'm doing hasbara, right? After Ari's murder, my older brother, who I'm sure we'll talk about, that kind of pulled me into the conflict, and I kind of half removed the mask and talked a little bit more about the conflict, about geopolitics, but I was still a tech guy. October 7th, that mask went away. And I decided it wasn't like a conscious decision that I sat and I analyzed the risk factor. I just said, this is not, you know, the world doesn't need marketing right now. And so I shut down a multi-million dollar consulting business and refocused my energy on a mission with two components, I would say. First one is being a source of real-time accurate information. Just like real-time and accurate are generally mutually exclusive, right? Because if it's real-time, I can't verify. But because I'm getting feeds from like the Knesset and from the IDF spokesperson, so I'm able to cross-reference, make sure that I'm tweeting and posting accurate things. And then the second part is just giving us a reason to get up in the morning, just like giving everyone a reason to smile in this time of devastation. That's what I've been doing for a year and a half, basically. And, you know, it's been incredibly gratifying for my neshama and for the state of Israel. Not so much for my bank account, to be totally honest. But, you know, listen, Hashem has been really very clear that this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. Again, like, you know, the Knesset invited me for an award, and like, it's been very nice. It's been very beautiful. And I don't have any doubts whatsoever this is what I need to be doing. But, it's rough. It's definitely not only from a monetary perspective. I mean, when you put yourself out there, something that I've known always, but now with politics, like the amount of hate that I get is just absolutely insane. Like, from replies to my tweets, to emails, to offline, to death threats, like I'm going to a certain place in a couple of months to speak, and they have 30 security guards just for me.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So, I mean, that's definitely a downside, but 2.5 billion impressions later.
Not bad.
Yeah.
So you've said it many times, and it's the title of this episode, Every Jew Belongs in Israel. Where does that belief come from? What's the source of this passion, personally, historically, spiritually?
So first of all, on a personal level, I grew up in a family of hardcore Zionists, right? When I moved here, I'm sure when you moved here, to move to Israel, you needed to be a hardcore Zionist, right? Like you couldn't get orange juice in this country.
Right.
You know? Today, it's no longer the case, and we'll talk about that. But when I came here when I was 15, hardcore Zionists. But I was thinking a lot about this question throughout the war. And I have two things to say on this topic of all Jews belonging in Israel. Well, I have a few things to say, but let's start with this. You know, everyone knows the famous story of the guy that gets on the roof in the storm, right? Those that might not know, there's a storm, a guy gets on the roof and he says, Hashem will save me, mm-hmm. right? And everyone's evacuating, and they send him a boat. They say, get in the boat. He says, no, Hashem will save me. And then they send him a helicopter. They say, get in the helicopter. No, Hashem will save me. And then he drowns. And he goes with Hashem. He says, Hashem, I don't get it. Like, I believed in you. Hashem, why didn't you save me? Hashem says, I didn't save you. I sent you a boat. I sent you a helicopter. You didn't get on, right? The way I see it, Mashiach should come. But after 120 years, if Mashiach doesn't come, many Jews are going to go up to Hashem and say, Hashem, I don't get it. I said Ani Mamin every day. For thousands of years, Jews davened to come home to Israel. Kibbutz Galios. Why didn't you bring us home? Hashem's going to say, I didn't bring you home. What do you even say? I brought you El Al. I brought you Nefesh B'Nefesh. I made Israel a paradise to live in. And then I sent you anti-Semitism, just in case you had any thought that maybe you're still home, that you still didn't get on the boat, right? So that's the way I see it. I mean, Hashem is like literally saying to us, enough already. Like, what do I have to do? What do I have to do to show you that you're no longer home anywhere in the world besides Israel? That's first of all. And second of all, I was thinking about this literally this Shabbos. You know, it's a question, right? Like, Mashiach comes, then I come to Israel, or I come to Israel, then Mashiach comes, right? That's the debate between many Jews around the world. The way I see it, I'm comparing it to childbirth, right? In other words, we're going to be born, reborn as a nation in our homeland. But, you know, a birth doesn't start before labor. Mm-hmm. The baby has to be ready to come out, right? And then you go into labor. They have to start moving. They have to show that they're ready to leave. And then Hashem will do the rest, right? because this is a real, you know, a fundamental principle. You see, this isn't even like commentary or Gemara. This is literally like in the Torah. Hashem's, we're standing at Yam Suf, right? And we scream to Moshe, what do you do? Bring us back to Egypt. And Moshe screams to Hashem, what are you doing? What does Hashem say? Debrel b'nei Yisrael v'yisau. What are you looking at me for? Get in the water and go. So like, what are we waiting for? And again, I say this, by the way, I should probably give a disclaimer and say, nothing I'm about to say is coming from a judgmental perspective. Mm-hmm. It's a place of love. But if I say, and this is what I say to my friends in America, I say, and not only in America, but especially in America, I say, if I had told you 10 years ago that in 10 years from now, they're going to be anti-Semites in Congress, they're going to be shoes vandalized, they're going to be windows shattered, Jews are going to be beaten in the streets of America, and academic institutions are not going to let Jews around, walk around freely, what would you do? If I had told you that 10 years ago, anybody with a half a brain would have said to me, that's never going to happen in America. And if it does, I'm out of here.
Right.
And here we are. So like I grew up my whole life, you know, wondering like, what did my grandmother think was going to happen? Like when Hitler was just talking, it was just rhetoric. That's one thing. But when they legislated the Nuremberg laws, what did she think was going to happen? What had to have happened for her to leave? Mm-hmm. And I never understood the answer to that question. And then I look at my friends and I'm like, are you insane? Like what would constitute a gun to your head? Like what hasn't happened, mm-hmm. you know? But the reality is this is the same mistake we make throughout the generations, right? I mean, you know, look in the Torah. Like there are two instances that the Jews were told go into Israel. And there were two narratives they told themselves, right? First, it was Egypt. Hashem's like, all right, get out of here. 80% stayed. Like, I don't know if you ever asked yourself this question. I never asked myself. It's like 80% stayed back after the 10 Makos and everything that Hashem did. Like, what were they telling themselves? Like, think about it. Try to get into their mindset. The only way I can reconcile this illogical thing is by saying, okay, these Israelites, because they weren't Jews yet, said, I'm Egyptian. I was born here. My parents were born here. My grandparents were born here. I'm Egyptian, land of milk and honey. I'm not running away, right? That's one narrative. Mm-hmm. I'm comfortable here. And you say, but you're a slave. Yeah, but I have a roof over my head. But you're being persecuted. Yeah, but I have food on the table. Are you insane?
I'm American.
It's crazy, right? We'll get there, right? Okay. But then the second narrative is the Meraglim. Did you ever ask yourself, how could it be? I never asked myself this question. It's like
the spies.
Right, the spies, right? Famously, Hashem, God says to go into the land of Israel. They say, let's send spies, right? They send 12 of the biggest rabbis of the generation, the heads of the tribe. Mm-hmm. 10 of them come back, famously, and say bad things about Israel. 10 of the biggest rabbis of the generation are saying, no, God, we're not going to listen to you. We're going to stay in the desert. How could that be? What were they telling themselves? And again, I never asked myself that question, but the answer is so obvious, right? They're saying, I'm in the desert. I have a direct line of communication with Hashem. I have food coming out of the heavens. I have clouds of glory protecting me. I am very frum. I'm going to stay in the desert in Lakewood where I'm very frum. I'm not going to go into Israel where I have to build an economy and an army and God forbid my kids are going to see Jews with tattoos. I'm going to stay in Lakewood and in Teaneck and in the Five Towns and in Borough Park because I'm very frum here. These are the two narratives, comfort and religion. Mm-hmm. Right? You have the vast majority of American Jews say, I'm not running away, right? We've all seen this. Yeah, the anti-Semitism, I'm not running away, I'm American, right? And then the more frum, the more religious, the more right-wing Jews mm-hmm. will say, going to Israel? My kid's going to go off the derech, right? My kid's going to become less religious. And I'm like, do you hear what you're saying? Hashem's saying going to Israel, and you're saying, no, I'm too religious to listen to Hashem. Are you insane, right? But it's the same narratives. It's the same stuff we say in every generation. This is what we're seeing today, and it's wild.
So you're preempting a lot of my questions. And one of them is that, this is very frustrating for me, and it's something I think about a lot. There's so many rabbis and leaders and communities outside of Israel, respected voices who care so deeply about Am Yisrael, and yet so few of them are encouraging their communities to make Aliyah. In some cases, they're even holding them back. Why do you think this is happening? And why aren't there more leaders in the diaspora helping their communities take that step?
It's a great question. You know, I don't want to speak badly about big rabbis, of course.
Right.
But I'll quote this. I'm sure he's a friend of yours, you know, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg in Boca Raton, right? He said something that really deeply, deeply resonated with me. He said, American Jews need to understand they're on a business trip, right? When you're on a business trip, you get a nice car, get a nice hotel, you're living it up, but you're on a business trip, you're going home. Don't get confused, right? And he's in Boca Raton, he's living the life, right? But just understand that this is not your home. And again, Hashem keeps showing you in different ways that it's not your home. So, you know, the rabbis that stay there, it's again, who am I to say this? But like, it's their it's the Moroccan modern day Moroccan. It's like right. Let's stay in America and be from. Mm-hmm. And she's like, that's not your job. Get in Israel. Get into Israel. Like, no, I'm going to stay from.
I have a lot of clients. I mean, the first thing I ask people that turn to me for help with buying a home, what's the purpose? What's the purpose of your purchase? And most of the time it's, you know, we want to have a place to come to for the chagim, for vacation, and just in case we have to run away. And I always say, well, why didn't you think about moving here? Or why didn't you think about bringing your family here? We'll come when Mashiach comes. And I'm dumbfounded. I often don't know how to answer that. What would you say to people?
I'd say Mashiach will come when you come home. Where did you get this idea that we're only going to, do you only keep Shabbos when Mashiach comes? Do you only keep kosher when Mashiach comes? It's literally a mitzvah in the Torah to settle the land of Israel. I mean, there's basically no like rabbinic authority that doesn't think that living in Israel is a mitzvah today. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there's the extremist, but like it's a mitzvah.
Right.
It's literally, so what, I'm going to wait for Mashiach to do a mitzvah. Like, where did you get this concept from? It's a crazy thing. So, you know, okay. So then you could say, oh, but like, you know, my parents are elderly and need to stay in America, or my kid has special needs. Okay, great. These are all legitimate things, but at least have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like those that say that Israel's not even on their radar, it's like, what kind of Jew just now, I'm not, God forbid, saying, you know, I'm perfect and I keep all 613 mitzvahs. No, but there's a very big difference between, you know, not doing something and making something effort into an ideal. Like, Israel's not on my radar? What?
Mm-hmm.
How could you not? So, I mean, I sit with my friends and I bang my head against the wall.
I mean, I also say to people, if you won the lottery, would you say, I'll come back and take it in 20 years? Yeah. You'll grab it.
Yeah.
We've won the lottery. We have the greatest gift we could ever dream of.
And again, I want to be clear, like people, you know, I hear this every day. By the way, speaking of Rabbi Fass, like he's a very dear friend and I love the guy, but we were buying flowers for our wives on a Friday morning and I gave him a piece of my mind. Because I get 3 phone calls a week from people saying to me, Nefesh B'Nefesh told me I have to cut my salary in half. So I said to Rabbi Fass, who's telling people that? He said, I have no idea. I said, but that's not true. He said, it's not true. It's just not true anymore. I mean, yeah, there are some sacrifices. Cars cost more. But if you're good at what you do and you're willing to work hard, you could make as much money here. You could live. I don't feel like I lowered my quality of life here at all whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I speak to my friends in the 5 towns who are making obscene amounts of money. They're not living a better life than I am.
Right.
And I don't mean, by the way, spiritual. I mean materialistically. I lack nothing. I say to my kids on a regular basis, I say to them, is there anything you want in this world that you don't have? No.
Amazing.
Like, we are living the life here. Once upon a time, again, you couldn't get tuna fish here. You couldn't get, but now Israel's paradise. I sit with people almost on a daily basis, Americans, Brits. Mm-hmm. I say to them, how do you feel? They all say the same thing. Infinitely safer here than I do there.
Right.
Like, there's really no big sacrifice anymore. It's just, it's an amazing country.
Amazing. And the majority of people, or I'd say a large number of people, they just need a seat and internet connection to do their work.
Yeah.
There's no excuse.
Yeah.
And they can get the same salary. They can carry on their jobs. Right. And sometimes the time difference is in their interest.
I want to emphasize that point, right? It's true that if you're a doctor, you know, making millions of dollars, or you're a lawyer or whatever, that, you know, you're going to have to work a little harder to figure it out. Maybe you'll travel. But like 99% of professions, you can make as much, if not more money here. Like if you're good at what you do, if you're at the bottom of the corporate chain and you're a janitor, then okay, you'll probably make more money there. But if every other profession, again, it goes without saying if you're in tech. I mean, if you're an engineer, obviously Israel's at the pinnacle of that, right? But most professions, if you're good at what you do, you can make a great living here.
Right.
Maybe even better.
Mm-hmm. And we discussed this last week with Rabbi Fass, how people reinvent themselves here. It's like land of creation. You don't have to fit into a box.
That's right.
And I always say as well, it's not about what you do, it's what you do on the side that counts.
Right.
So many people do different things. I met someone recently who manages properties in the evening for people who are living abroad.
Right.
And that supplements his income.
It's a great example, because my brother, Donnie, he was a social worker, right? And one of his closest friends, his parents had an apartment in Jerusalem. He said, listen, can you just go into the apartment once in a while, turn on the electricity, pay the bills, just take care of it for them.
Right.
Like, of course. So he did it, and he did such a good job. They told their friends. Now he has a massive business managing properties in Jerusalem.
Amazing.
Massive. So, I mean, again, like you said, when I talk to people like, I've done this, so I can do this in Israel. I'm like, no, that's not the way to look at it. In Israel, there's no corporate hierarchy of like, I'm just a normal guy, so I can't have lunch with whoever. Everybody's happy to have a cup of coffee in this country. You can make things happen. View it as an opportunity.
True.
Like, now's the time maybe to restart your career. Maybe in America, you know, you dreamt of being an engineer, but you didn't make it, so you were in sales. You're coming to Israel now. reinvent yourself. Mm-hmm. Make it an opportunity. Not
never
like,
be afraid to ask.
100%.
And don't say no for an answer.
That's right.
The word no in Israel doesn't exist. Really means yes. Right. You just got to keep pushing until you get the answer.
I always say, like, if you want to have lunch with Mark Zuckerberg in Silicon Valley, it's not going to happen. Right. No matter how many strings you pull. In Israel, if you want to have lunch with whatever, the CEO of Wix, it's an email and a half and you're there.
Look at me. I got a podcast with Hillel Fold.
I got a podcast with you. I'm just saying, you can get to anyone in this country. There's no like, oh, I'm too important to meet you. Everybody's right. Chill. Everybody's informal. And you could make stuff happen in this country that you okay. can't in other places.
Beautiful. Hillel, let's talk about your brother, Ari Hashem Yakum Damo. He was a hero, a teacher, a fighter, and a voice for truth and justice. Ari was murdered in a terror attack in 2018 while doing what he always did, defending the Jewish people. Even in his final moments, he chased down and neutralized the terrorist to protect others. Can you tell us how his life and his sacrifice continues to impact your work and your message, especially bringing Jews home to Israel?
Sure. So we're five brothers. Ari was the one above me in the lineup. He came before us. So he just picked up middle of his life and moved to Israel. Volunteered the IDF, climbed up the ranks of the IDF. He was what's called a magist, which is a guy that carries around a machine gun called a mag in Hebrew, or a mag in English. It's a machine gun that's literally built to put on a tank, mm-hmm. for real. Like, it's not meant for a human being to carry, but right. he was a beast, you know? So he carried that around. He climbed up the ranks. He got out of the army. He continued to volunteer for reserve duty. And he got his exemption papers, and he continued to volunteer. Even at his funeral, his sergeant said, like, he told Ari, like, okay, you're not 18 anymore. Like, give the mug to someone else. And Ari's like, he wouldn't even hear of it, you know? Wow. So he was like a real, you know, a real warrior, a real hero. And you know, that was on the army side. On the professional side, he dedicated his life to, you know, soldiers and to Am Yisrael, fighting for his people online. And I tell you a story that I don't tell very often, but at one point I said to him, Ari, like, you got a family, let's make you some money. I'll get you into tech. So I got him a job in tech. And Miriam tells this story. It's a really beautiful story. One of the things that Ari, first of all, Ari learned like 24/7. He was always, you never, always Gemara, always Siyums, and he was always finishing tractates of Shas and Gemara. And so there was one time when he was working in tech and he made a Siyum in his house and he said, Anu mashkimim v'hei mashkimim. Anu mashkimim, right?
What is mashkimim, explain very, what that means.
So at the ceremony of filling finishing a tractate of the Talmud, there's a prayer that we say. One of the phrases that we say in that prayer is, we get up to go learn in the study hall of Talmud, and other nations get up to enjoy life and party, mm-hmm. right? And as he said those words, he broke down crying. He's like, what am I doing in tech? Like, this is not what I need to be doing. And he just quit, left.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So he dedicated his life to his people, his Torah, his land. And 6.5 years ago, he was walking in Gush Etzion, and near 10 minutes outside of Jerusalem, what the world likes to call the West Bank, just so we understand, 10 minutes outside of the capital of Israel, and shopping for his family on the day before Yom Kippur. And an Arab kid, which is an extremely important emphasis, kid, not a Hamas terrorist, not someone who is quote unquote being occupied or oppressed, just a kid, like who had everything he in life, he lived in an affluent life, decided today was a good day to murder a Jew. And so he came from behind, stabbed Ari in the neck. And it was his lucky day because he got him in the main artery. So Ari was basically clinically dead immediately. But somehow, miraculously, and I mean that quite literally, he was able to chase down the terrorist, jump over a wall, and shoot the terrorist, not kill him, but shoot him when he was just inches away from his next victim, a woman named Hila, who had just served the terrorist a falafel because she had a falafel stand there, not knowing he's a terrorist. And she was his next victim, and Ari shot him and saved her life. Hila has since become part of the Fold family. He saved someone in his last breath. So he became a national hero of the state of Israel. So it's kind of like that cognitive dissonance that we all feel in general living in Israel. It's like, on the one hand, like tremendous tragedy and loss. On the other hand, what pride. Like, if I told my grandmother in Auschwitz that her grandson would be a national hero of the state of Israel, she would say, the state of what? Right. And so, yeah, you know, it's, again, it's tragedy and it's pride.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this has fueled your energy, right. your determination?
I think, I think pretty often I ask myself, WWAD, what would Ari do?
Mm. Right?
Because we actually had a little bit of a debate as far as online and the way to manage and debate with people. He was very much of the opinion that you should engage with everyone. No matter what, like, it doesn't matter if they're listening or not listening, because other people see that dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Always engage. And I'm like, he's probably right. Like, but I can't deal with the volume. I can't engage with everyone. But I just feel like if someone's not listening, if someone's calling me Hitler, like, am I really going to waste my time on that person? But oftentimes someone will write me something and I'll say to myself, what would Ari do? And I'll engage. So yeah, he definitely, you know, I definitely feel like I'm channeling Ari when I'm doing what I'm doing. But did I ever tell you, or did you ever hear about his name? Story about his name?
No.
Unbelievable
story. I'm into names, so tell me.
He's just going to blow your mind. Go on. For real, it's going to blow your mind. So when Ari was born, now he would be 52 last week, so whatever, I mean, yeah, 52 years ago. Wow, that's crazy. Okay, so when he was born, my parents named him Ari. Mm-hmm. The name Ari wasn't very common. Aria was common, right? Mm-hmm. People called their kids Ari as a shortcut for Aria, but the name Ari, this is his real name, Ari. So people said to my parents, like, where'd you get that name? And they're like, yeah, we just liked the name. They didn't really think much of it. Then Ari grew up to be who he became. And you met him, right? You knew him.
Yes,
right?
We did.
So he was a pretty normal, chill guy, but there were certain things about him that were like fiery passion, right? So there were certain things he was very, very passionate about. So first of all, again, he came here before everyone and he conquered this land. Like he was a real warrior, mm-hmm. right? That's first of all. Second of all, I would wake up sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd see him on Facebook debating some anti-Semite. And I'd be like, Ari, go to sleep. What are you doing? Like the guy's not even listening to you. I don't know when he slept. Like for real, he was fighting mm-hmm. all day, every day for Jews. Like he did not sleep, okay? That's two. Three, he was fiery passionate about tefillah, about praying, right? You would see him all the time, like praying with his tefillin, you know, I don't know if you say tefillin in English, but he was very, very passionate about prayer. Mm-hmm. But not just any prayer, the prayer of Shema. Right, Hear, O Israel, right? You could see, you know, you could see videos online of him like yelling with like a loudspeaker, Shema Yisrael Hashem. Like he was very passionate about Shema. And finally, the last thing he was very passionate about was tzitzis. Like you could see tons of videos with this talus on his head. Like those were the things he was passionate about. Okay, mm-hmm. So let's just go over the things that we just said. Okay, mm-hmm. One, he was a warrior that conquered the land. Two, he did not sleep. Three, he was fiery passionate about prayer. Four, Shema. Mm-hmm. And five tzitzis, okay?
Okay.
After he was murdered, my parents opened the Tanakh. And they said, where did we get that name from? Sit down, hold on to your chair, because you're not going to believe I'm about to tell you. For real, like, this is absolutely insane. So they looked it up. They said, where does the word Ari appear in the Torah? And the answer is, the word Ari appears twice in the entire Torah. And when they read the Pesukim, and they read what it says about the word Ari, they almost had a heart attack. You ready for this?
Go on.
Okay. The first pasuk says, "Hein am kelavi akum lo, a people that rises like a lion, the cha'arit nasa, like an ari, like a lion, leaps up like the king of beasts." Okay, now, if I were to say to you, define a lion, you would say the king of beasts, you'd say the strongest animal, you'd say many things. Mm-hmm. I'm reading to you, like, literally what Rashi says. Karasha chav ki'ari, they crouch, they lie down like a lion. I'm reading this to you, you could see it if you don't believe me. Yitiyash kitargumo, Rashi, with the commentary on the Torah, says, understand it like another commentary. Unkelus is another commentary on the Torah. What is a lion? This is what it says. They will be settled in their land in strength and might.
Wow.
Like what? That's how you define a lion? They settle their land in strength and might.
Wow.
And here's the second time. They rise up like a lion. And the Torah, this is the Torah. This isn't even the commentary. How does the Torah characterize a lion? What does it say? It could say many things about a lion. What does it say? I'm reading the words. Lo yishkav ad yochal teref. A lion doesn't sleep until it consumes its prey. And here's Rashi. This is just bonkers. I'm reading the words. Hinam kelavi akum. Kshein omdim yishnatam shacharit. In the morning, hen mitgabrim kelavi v'chari. They overcome like a lion. Lachtof et hamitzvot. To grab the mitzvot. To grab the Torah commandments. And what three commandments does Rashi say? Out of the 613 commandments that he could have chosen, this is what he says. Lachtof et hamitzvot, lilvosh talit, likro et shema, ulhaniach tefillin.
Unbelievable.
To wear the tzitzis, to read the shema, and to pray with tefillin.
Wow.
This is what Rashi says.
Your parents had Ruach HaKodesh.
So, I mean, that is a thing,
it's
right?
So, you thick.
Know, it's a thing, right? You know, you give a kid a name, and he grows into that person. But yep. That's just wild. So, you know, you said you're into names. I'll share something else with you. After this, like, after I understand, I'm like, you can't debate that. That is literally what he stood for. Those mm-hmm. are the things that he stood for. I mean, it's crazy. So I said to myself, well, what about my name? So I was talking to someone about this and they said, what's your name? They said, what do you like doing in your life? Like what do you do in your career, right? And anybody who follows me will tell you, will attest that I like praising other people, empowering people.
Hello.
Just wait. I like empowering other people. That's what I do. I empower entrepreneurs. That's what I do, right? I said, okay, well, you like empowering other people. What does that make you feel? Right? And I'm not thinking about my name here. I'm just speaking. And I'm like, it's really, I would say it's part of my essence. Like it makes me feel very much alive. Like it really, like praising other people makes me feel alive. They said, okay, well, what else does it make you feel? And I said, it's part of me. Like I don't know why it's part of me, but I was born with it or I was taught it. I don't know, but it makes me feel whole. Mm. That's what I said. I didn't, again, I wasn't even thinking about my name.
Don't tell me your middle name is Shalom.
Hillel Chaim Shlomo.
No way.
Chaim alive.
Shlomo.
Shalom. It's whole.
Unbelievable.
It's like, I mean, again, is it like confirmation bias? Am I convincing myself? I mean, I think if objectively you look at my work, it's what I do. I feature people every day. I promote startups. I promote other people. That's what I love doing. That's
beautiful.
I was like, that was blew my mind.
Beautiful.
But anyway, back to Israel. I think, you know, like you said, we have, you know, God is literally just like giving us this gift on a silver platter. And again, by the way, to be clear, like I'm not saying it's easy to like pick up and leave your life and, you know, this whole life that you built in America. I'm not belittling that, right? I mean, that's a very valid thing to say, oh, I can't just pick up and leave. I get that. Mm-hmm. But at least have a plan. At least like know that you're on a business trip. Don't get confused. You're not home. Like, you know, yeah, America was safe or, you know, comfortable for Jews for a very long time. And that's true. But it's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no longer pretty much across the board. You know, it's not like we're talking LA, we're talking New York, obviously Europe. That's a whole different discussion. But like, what, where, how, and my friends in Teaneck, they say to me, oh, it doesn't affect me. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, get in a car and drive for 30 seconds. So you have to wait till it like knocks on your door? Mm-hmm. Like what has to happen? Once they knock on your door, it's too late. You know, so it's just, it boggles my mind.
Yeah. What about people who are not religious or someone who's not affiliated in any way?
Yeah, I don't think it's a religious thing though.
Right.
It's a national thing. It's our nation. It's our heritage. It's our tradition. I mean, again, you don't have to be religious. You don't have to say, okay, I pray to Jerusalem every day for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. You could say I'm a Jew. And unfortunately, sadly, many Jews were led to the gas chambers asking themselves, why am I being led to the gas chambers? I'm German.
Right.
They didn't even know they were Jewish. They didn't identify as Jews, but it didn't matter to Hitler.
I just read a report last week in the Jerusalem Post about a survey that was done. I think it's 25% of Jews in America do not affiliate with Judaism, yeah. And 100% of Jews in Israel do affiliate with Judaism. Right. I think that's very telling.
Yeah, I think someone said to me recently, in America you can succeed despite being a Jew. In Israel you can succeed because you're a Jew.
Yeah, fair.
Right?
Beautiful.
So, I mean, you know, like it's the same script keeps repeating itself over and over again. I mean, I can tell you, listen, I'm not a prophet. I will say that on October 5th, 2 days before October 7th, I wrote a post.
Which you
can go verify. I said something big is about to happen and Israel will be at the center of it. I said, pay attention to what's going on. Everything's on a boiling point, right? Now, again, how did I know that? Not because I'm a prophet, but because I read history books and I know what's about to happen. Mm-hmm. It's the same script. I'll tell you right now what's about to happen. Mark, here, we have it on record, so you can look back and say, Hillel was right. Here's what happens, okay? It's the same script. You have an empire. The empire grows and grows until it reaches world domination, right? Ancient Egypt, Rome, Greece, Soviet, Nazi, it's all the same, right? An empire just keeps growing. When it reaches just unparalleled power and influence, the first thing that it does is it throws morality out the window, right? You put people to fight to the death in the Colosseum for the emperor's entertainment, mm-hmm. right? No more morality. Now, when an empire doesn't want morality, it doesn't want our morality shoved down their throats, right? Because how does the world know it's immoral to murder? Because in ancient times, it wasn't. Where did that come from? It came from the Bible. So if you don't want morality, the last thing you want is the Bible. So that they can't come after the creator of the Bible, because that's God. So what do? They come after the messenger. Right? You kill FedEx, you don't get your package, right? And then we, in every generation, we come to our host and we say, hey, Greeks, don't hate us. We're just like you. In fact, we're more Greek than you. Hey, Americans, don't hate us. We're the most liberal people in America today. We are more American than you. And then our host has to remind us who we are. And they say, you're not just like us. We have a tool we've developed to show you you're not just like us. It's called anti-Semitism. And then anti-Semitism spikes and then the empire falls. That's what happens in every generation. So I don't want to, God forbid, say that Western civilization is falling and Trump might reverse this trajectory, but it's not headed in a good direction because anti-Semitism is through the roof.
And Trump's only in office for 4 years.
Yeah. So he might push it off, might slow it down, but unless things reverse themselves, we're in trouble.
Right. I don't feel like we need to discuss, you know, how amazing life in Israel is, but I mean, the meaningfulness here is just incomparable. We were at a wedding the other night. The atmosphere and the speeches and the experience under the chuppah is something that's incomparable.
Yeah. Oh,
you know,
100%.
We had a chayal who was injured who stood up and said the tefillah, the prayer for the soldiers. The rabbi who spoke about some of his students who have been killed and the meaningfulness, overlooking the city of Jerusalem, the meaningfulness of what we're fighting for.
Yeah.
You don't get that in 100%. A wedding in England or America.
100%. And by the way, everything we've said till now aside, you know, I had a conversation with a couple of months ago. He's American. She's originally Israeli. Mm-hmm. Okay. And her father is a famous psychologist in Israel. And they tell me that for years and years, the father's been saying to them, you got to make Aliyah, you got to make Aliyah, right? Then the war broke out. And the father, who's a psychologist, said, you can't bring your kids to Israel now. It will cause them psychological damage. First of all, I blew my lid. I was so upset to hear that. But I said, listen, far be it from me to, you know, criticize your father. I'm sure he's a brilliant man. But I said to him, to the father, the husband and the wife, I said, listen, if you think that when your kids grow up, they're going to look at you and say, Mom and Dad, thank you so much for leaving us in America when our brothers and sisters were fighting the existential war in Israel, you are sorely mistaken. They're going to look at you with disgust. And they're going to say, you think you stayed in America for us? How did you abandon your brothers and sisters in Israel? How did you not get on a plane? It's a sad thing to say. People don't want to hear it. But how could you not get on a plane to support us right now? Mm-hmm. Forget what you need us. We need you.
Right.
Get on a plane. Right? And you talked about weddings, but like, it's not even, you don't even have to go to the extraordinary nature of a wedding. Just day-to-day life. I mean, I'm sure you saw this post I wrote, but a couple of weeks ago, I'm driving and all of a sudden my car starts making crazy noises. I get out and I have a massive flat tire, like totally flat. Like it looked like it had been slashed. That's my first thought. But anyway, I'm like, what do I do now? I don't even have a spare tire. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. And I'm like, oh, I remember this organization that people told me about called Yedidim, which means friends.
Amazing.
So I'm like, all right, let's try this. Call Yedidim. I'm sitting there on the side of the road. I don't know, 15 minutes later, some random dude, looks like a kid, pulls up. He's like, all right, I heard you have a flat tire. I'm like, yeah, like my first instinct is like, okay, what do I have to pay you for this? He's like, nothing. He's like, I'm volunteering. I'm like, why do you, like, what do you mean you're volunteering? You just stop in life in the middle of on a Sunday morning. Like, what? Why are you doing this? Like, he didn't understand the question. He's like, what do you mean? Of course I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. So he starts helping with my car. Another car stops. This 85-year-old man driving is like, can I help? I'm like, oh my God, like what, where are we? What planet are we on right now, you know? And this guy fixed my tire, drove with me from like place to place to find a replacement tire. And he just like, he wouldn't, I said, let me pay you. He wouldn't even like hear of it,
right?
You know?
And that's just a typical day in Israel.
Correct. And afterwards, when I wrote him, you know, on WhatsApp, I said, you know, thank you so much. He goes to me, I should read you the message, but he goes to me, I looked you up online. He goes, thank me? Thank you, because I wrote a post, whatever.
So cute.
And meanwhile, I wrote this post. It went pretty viral. And then the CEO of Yedidim contacted me. He's like, can we translate your post into Hebrew? And it became a whole thing, you know?
Hilarious.
That's life in Israel. Life. Like, we're, with all due, by the way, you know, the division in Israel makes me sad. But like, yeah, there are family, you know, feuds. People, you know, families fight sometimes, right. But we're family. And if anybody thinks for a split second that if I was on the side of the road or if I was, I don't know what, God forbid something happened to me, that these people on Kaplan, these leftists, even quote unquote anti-religious people wouldn't step up for me, then you're kidding yourselves.
Correct.
Right? At the end of the day, we are family here.
Yep.
Yes, we have some drama, but yep. families have drama.
So true. So going back to what you were saying about how the kids will turn to their parents and say, why didn't you take us to Israel? I tell people, do this for your children.
Yes.
Because they're going to end up here.
Yeah.
If you think your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren are going to live comfortably forever after wherever you are, you know, then you're probably wrong. And if you really care, then do it sooner than later, because the earlier the children come, the easier things are.
100%. And you know, this war, it's important. Like, yeah, I'm not, listen, no one has to lecture me on losing loved ones to war and to terror, right? But like, if you, it's hard to do, but if you take a step back, right? And you think about telling your grandson about this war, right? Your grandson will say, all right, so tell me about this war. And you'll say, well, we were in shul, we were in synagogue on this holiday, and 5,000 terrorists, genocidal maniacs, poured into Israel with 8 hours of free hand to do whatever they wanted and unlimited access to automatic weapons. Your grandson's going to say to you, that's terrible. How many millions of people did they kill that day? And you're going to say, no, they didn't kill millions of people. You're going to say, okay. He's going to say, okay, how many hundreds of thousands? No, they didn't kill hundreds of thousands. How many tens of thousands? Not tens of thousands. How many people did they kill? 1,200. Now, open parentheses, 1,200 is a number I can't even fathom and digest. 1,200 worlds. And I'm not, God forbid, dismissing that.
Of course.
But also, take a step back and realize that to say the word miracle about October 7th is difficult. Okay, so call it whatever you want. but 1,200 people, 5,000 terrorists, 8 hours, spraying bullets and all that. We should have had hundreds of thousands of casualties. But you know what?
And the Khatofim, of course.
Of course, right. But you know what? Let's put aside October 7th. Forget October 7th, okay? People talk about this Iron Dome thing like it's a normal thing. Like, I spoke to Dr. Danny Gold, who invented the Iron Dome. And I said, tell me the story. He said, rockets are raining down on Israel. And he brought the brightest minds in the country into a room. He said, we have to solve this problem. And everyone came up with their solutions. And he said, that's just not good enough. I want to detonate the rockets midair. And there was silence in the room. They're like, you can't do that. Like, rockets are in the air for seconds. Like, that's not even technically possible. He said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And he went to the Israeli army and he said, I want to build a system that detonates the rockets midair. They're like, you can't do that. He said, well, that's what I'm going to do. So he went to the Israeli government. They said, you can't do that. And then he went to the State Department. He went to the American. Every single person, military strategists at the highest levels, said, you cannot do that. And here we are with this system that detonates rockets at 96% precision.
How do you explain that?
It's a miracle. It's the splitting of the sea. It is an open miracle, right? And even those missiles, rockets that don't get detonated by the Iron Dome, falling in empty spaces. I mean, you're a real estate person. Where are there empty spaces in this country? There ain't no empty spaces. Right, these are miracles, right? People don't realize this. You know, those two nights when Iran attacked Israel, right? Yeah, we detonated 99% of these ballistic missiles and drones. Like, we just accept that as normal. Do you understand? People don't get this, okay? Israel has three aerial defense systems, okay? We have the Iron Dome, which is up to a certain height, mm-hmm. right? Then you have the David Sling, which is a little higher. Then you have the Arrow system, which is outside of Earth's atmosphere, okay? Each one of those independently is a miracle, okay? But they were never built to work together. Mm-hmm. They just weren't. They were never built to work in unison. Those nights that Iran attacked and we detonated 90, each one of these systems worked perfectly with the other two.
Unbelievable.
And I'm not saying this. Go watch the people who operated those nights, and they'll say to you, like, this is miraculous stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's so clear, despite all the challenges, that, like, God's got our back here.
Right. So those people that say, I feel safer in America or in England than I do in Israel.
It's ludicrous.
Ludicrous.
And I'll tell you something else. Forget anecdotal. Forget, you know, experiences. Let's talk data. Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, no one has to lecture me on loss and terror. But here's a fact that my father likes to quote that is mind-boggling. There has never been a 60-year period in the history of the Jewish people ever with so few Jews being killed. Like, this country is defending us. It's protecting us. Now, again, every person that's lost to terror, it's an entire world. But in the macro, if you take a step back...
Even with October 7th.
Even with everything. Mm-hmm. This is the safest 60 years in the history of the Jewish people. So, yes, it's sad. Yes, there are rockets. Yes, there is. But at the end of the day, here's the fundamental difference. And this is what people don't get. Mm-hmm. In Israel, there is something called the IDF. The IDF has a mission. That is to protect me and you. Okay, now, that mission failed on October 7th, and there's no sugarcoating that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean there's no mission. There's still a mission. Who's protecting you there? There's no one has a mission to protect you there. Right. I mean, we see these people, you know, holding Hamas and Hezbollah flags in the streets of New York. No one's doing a thing. So yes, again, we have to look into what happened on October 7th. But the IDF still exists so that I can live in peace.
Right.
There, no one's got your back.
Right. So talking about the IDF, Hillel, you and I both have sons serving in the IDF. It's something that fills us with so much pride, but also heartache. It's not easy. Just this morning, I said goodbye to my son as he headed back up to his base in the north. And like so many parents here, I don't know where he'll be tomorrow or even today. These kids are brave. They're incredible. They're holding so much on their shoulders. And I have to be honest, it's hard for me not to feel frustrated sometimes. Let's put aside for a moment the whole conversation about the Haredi community not serving. What about the thousands of young Jews growing up outside of Israel, living their lives, planning their futures, going to college, without Israel even being part of their picture? Yes, there are incredible lone soldiers who come from overseas, and I admire them so deeply. But there are so many more who don't. What are your thoughts on that?
It's very sad, honestly. And it's sad really for them. Like, they're brothers.
They're missing out.
They're brothers. This is not just another war.
Right.
This is the war. Right? Their brothers and sisters are dying, fighting for their people, and they're in America in their house in Woodmere.
Right.
Like, how do you, and now, I just want to be very clear, like, amazing things happening, people sending money and delegations, it's beautiful. We'll talk about that in a second, but How do you justify that? Like, how do you?
I have an incredibly hard time. I mean, we have so many yeshiva kids come here for Shabbos to this community. I walk home from shul and I see these adorable boys walking home in their designer suits. Yeah. You know, happily.
You could have a designer suit here too, you know.
You can, absolutely. Oh yeah, I love full. But
yeah, no, it's very sad.
I have to be honest. A little part of me feels like, why? Why is my son sleeping outside on the dust, wearing God knows what, this Shabbos, and you're walking through the streets in your designer suit, happily, like with not a worry in the world? Yeah. Why is it fair? Just because my kid has an Israeli passport and you don't, they're defending the Jewish people all over the world.
It's really, I agree. I could not agree with you more.
So what can we do about this?
So I'll tell you something. Speaking of Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, something beautiful that he said in the beginning of the war that I just absolutely love, really love it. By the way, if there's one thing that's like silver lining for me from this war, it's that the Torah came to life for me. Like so many things I never paid attention to before.
It's beautiful.
So listen to this example. This is stunning. He says like this, when Hashem says to Avram, leave your home, right? He says these four words that you've heard 1,000 times. I've heard 1,000 times. I never paid attention to. Va'avarcha mevarechecha, those who bless you, Abraham, the Jewish people, will be blessed. U'mikalelcha, those who curse you. Now, you don't have to be a grammar expert to see what the next word should be. It should say, "Va'avarcha mevarechecha, those who bless you will be blessed." And it's the same root of the word, bracha, blessing. U'mikalelcha, those who curse you. The next word should be akalel, I will curse. But it doesn't say that. It says, "Va'avarcha mevarechecha, u'mikalelcha aor." Right? Aor means I will curse. But the obvious question, so obvious, is why did the Torah switch language?
Why a different word?
Yeah, why does it switch words, right? So Rabbi Goldberg said something stunning. The word aor has another word in it. Or, light.
Light.
Right? He says the right way to read that verse is Va'avarcha mevarechecha, those who bless you and stand by you in this war will be blessed. U'mikalelcha, those who curse you, those who don't have your back, they will see your light. They will see your delegations. They will see your charity. They will see your unity. They will see the most beautiful light coming out of this unbelievable nation.
That will pain them.
Well, that's, you said, but yeah.
No, I hope so.
But I'm saying like the light is very bright and very obvious. And I think, I'm not dismissing the frustration. I completely agree with you, but I still think that we are seeing some really, really unbelievable stuff come from the Jewish people throughout this war. Mm-hmm. Something that I never experienced before, let alone the Jews that are coming back to Judaism, right? I mean, I'm sure you saw this thing Chabad posted a couple of days ago where they took a survey of some Ivy League college and they said some Jewish kid, they said, do you have tefillin? And he said, no. And they said, well, if we bought you a pair of tefillin, would you wear it? And he said, yes. And they said, why? He said, because the Bibas family can't. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
I have to tell you something else though. Now, by the way,
please do.
This is going to, like, for real, this is going to give you chills. For real. Ready for this? This is unbelievable. The first thing that we know about the Jewish people, the first thing in the Torah, the first thing is they stand, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, the Jewish people parked by the foot of Mount Sinai, right? And famously, the Torah says Vayichan, they parked, but it says it in singular, right? Why doesn't it say Vayachnu, they parked? It says it parked or he parked or whatever, right? So famous, one of the most famous commentaries in the Torah, Rashi, he says, Ki ishachar b'levecha. They were like one man with one heart. They were unified. Mm-hmm. The first thing we know about the Jewish people is that our unity is our strength, right? And, you know, after October 7th, we were very unified. We all know that. But listen to this. A couple of weeks ago, tragedy again unified the Jewish people, the Bibas family, right? We were all unified that day or that week even.
Sure.
We were Ki ish echad b'levecha. You ready for this? Sit down for this. You ready? Ki ish. Kfir, Ariel, Yardane, Shiri.
Wow.
Keish. You heard this before?
I've had it before.
Isn't that the most beautiful thing ever?
Unbelievable.
Like someone told me that I was driving, I had to pull over to the side of the road.
It's crazy.
Unbelievable. Crazy. But the reality is, you know, unfortunately, this is the same script again. Like we were unified for like 12 seconds. And now again, it's like, I said this the other day. Like if you sat and made a list of 1,000 values, right? You took a Haredi from Mea Sharim and a Chiloni from Tel Aviv, and you went down the list of 1,000 values, they'd have about 800 of them in common, if not more, right? But we focus on the 200, and it's very sad. Not to say that the issues that are being debated and worse are not important, they are.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget that we are family and we share the same value system. It's true, you value religion more than you value the nation, the nation, fine. But like, let's not focus only on that 200 or that whatever percent it is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's focus on the fact that we are so much alike.
Right.
But unfortunately, it's terrible. I mean, you see what's going on right now. It's just terrible.
Hillel, I feel like we probably raise our children in a similar kind of environment. And I know that our children thank us very often for bringing them to Israel, for raising them here. And they would never choose to be anywhere else. Hillel, what would you tell one of your kids if they said they wanted to move back to America?
That's an interesting question. I don't think that I'd push back, because I would be so sure that within 12 seconds they would want to come back. Like when I go to America, you know, on business trips, I get off the plane, I see the nice cars, I see, you know, I go to Dougie's, get me poppers, or, you know, and I enjoy the materialism for like 12 seconds.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh my God, like barf, like get me home. I can't, there's no substance, there's no depth, there's nothing here.
Right.
You know, so I don't know that I'd push back on that. I'd be like, okay, yeah, go to America, have fun. I'll see you in 30 seconds, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
But I don't, that's such an unrealistic scenario, because my kids love it here. Like they'd never even think for that.
Amazing.
Like, you know, we think, because of the nature of my business, they travel. My kids have been to a lot of places around the world, and they all, you know, Italy is beautiful, and on a cruise, beautiful, but like they love Israel. Like
this Israel's home.
Yeah, for sure.
Amazing. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, the Haredi population.
Why is that the elephant in the room? You probably don't see eye to eye on this. Do you know that? Do you know my opinion on this?
I have no idea.
So why'd you say the elephant in the room?
I feel like nobody wants to talk about it. Okay, well, let's talk about the demographic trends. People are worried. What happens to Israel when so much of the population isn't working, isn't serving in the army, and is not receiving basic secular education? How do we build a functioning, unified society?
How do we do it for thousands of years?
For thousands of years, we didn't need an army. We didn't have secular education.
Why didn't we need an army? Because we had Torah.
Yeah, fair.
That's it. That's the whole thing. If you're learning Torah, of course we should support you. We didn't have the IDF for thousands of years. We didn't have anything. We had the Torah, and we're here. So, of course, we need an army. Of course, we need an economy. But if a person is sitting and dedicating their lives to learning Torah, the Jewish state shouldn't fund that? Of course it should. Now, let me just be very clear. There are two reasons that the Haredi rabbis say their kids shouldn't go to the army. One is learning Torah, and the other one's a lifestyle thing. He grew up in, you know, a ghetto, right? Mm-hmm. He's totally, you know, hasn't seen, wasn't exposed to the, you can't send him to the army because then they're going to, you know, see, God forbid, secular Israelis. I say God forbid, obviously, for she's like, not, you know, right. Sarcastically. But so I don't buy.
Mm-hmm.
If your kid, by going to the Israeli army, which is, I mean, this is a milchemes mitzvah, this is a war, like literally Hashem's commanding us to fight this, and your kid's going to become less religious by going to the army, then you didn't do a very good job educating your kid, mm-hmm. right? So the whole, oh, I can't send my kids to the army because he's not going to be religious, that's, I don't buy that. But if someone is actually learning Torah, they're in the base measures learning Torah, of course they should continue learning.
So we do see eye to eye, because those people that are learning, I agree, they should be learning. Right. But a large number of them are not sitting and learning seriously.
No, so those people.
I recently went to a shiva, a Haredi guy was sitting shiva, and his three sons were there. One of them, they're all quote unquote learning. One's dealing with watches. Another one is doing insurance, and another one's doing real estate. But they're learning. So.
That's not okay. Of course, that's not okay. But I think that most of our friends and acquaintances would say, even if a person's learning Torah, they should still serve. That I disagree with. I think that is serving, right? Not to mention, of course, the unbelievable organizations that, you know, the Haredim have, like, you know, from bone marrow transplants to Zaka, who picks up body parts. Like, the Haredim are doing a lot for this country, and we tend to forget that. And we also tend to forget, by the way, this is something that doesn't get enough attention in the media, how many secular Israelis don't serve.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive trend. I mean, you go to Tel Aviv, there are so many that do not serve.
And how did they get out of it?
They get out of it. You know, there's enough excuses, enough ways to get out if you want. But that doesn't get any media coverage, right? Only the mm-hmm. Haredim do. And so, and not to mention, by the way, the fact that my son is in a Haredi unit. There are Haredim in the IDF, right? Yes, it's true that the vast majority don't serve. But that's also a positive trend that we should pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Let's not ignore the fact that we're moving in the right direction. So again, I think the Jewish state and the Jewish government should absolutely fund Torah learning. Just like, by the way, on the flip side, the Jewish state should not fund Chil Shabbos, right? If you want to drive, you know, on a bus on Shabbos to the beach, go right ahead. But the Jewish state should fund that? That's crazy, right? So it's the same. If you're a Jewish state, you fund Torah learning.
Mm-hmm.
But Torah learning, the rest is...
Torah learning.
That's, if you're not going to go to the army because you're Haredi, you want to maintain your Haredi lifestyle, that's unacceptable.
That's not right. If you can speak directly to a Jew sitting in New York, London, or Johannesburg, what's the one message you would want them to hear?
We need you here. I'm not even talking about the fact that you need us. We need you here. Like, we're fighting for our existence. I mean, this is historical. This is not just another war. This is history being written. and you're not a part of it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to look back, whether it's in 5 years, 10 years, or your grandkids are going to look back and say, I don't believe that grandpa didn't come to Israel when Israel needed them. And I think that on the long, long list, and there was a long list of excuses / justifications to not come to Israel that once existed, a long list, pretty much all of them have disappeared. Mm-hmm. There's really no excuse today. Now, on a personal level, individually, if you know, your parents are elderly and it's hard, okay, I get that. But again, make a plan, right? Because you no longer have to sacrifice your quality of life. You no longer have to lower your salary. You no longer have to worry about food not being good or not getting deodorant or everything's here. This is paradise here. Israel is literally Gan Eden today. So like, what, and it's no longer comfortable to live there. So what are your excuses now? What are you telling yourself? You know, you could, I mean, a person can tell themselves, I'm in Teaneck, it doesn't affect me, and I have my big house, and I'm staying here. Okay, fine. But at least, like, verbalize what you're saying, right? When I say to my friends, they say, it's not going to happen here. I was like, okay, just say out loud the following sentence. It happened in every generation in the history of the world. The Jews were, persecuted and massacred and butchered. It happened in every generation, but it won't happen today. That's what you're thinking? That's your opinion? Do you hear how ridiculous that sounds?
Right.
So again, will there be concentration camps in America? No. Because in every generation, it takes on a new face.
Manifests itself differently.
But it's not going to get any better. Anti-Semitism is not going back in the bag. It's only going to get worse.
So I have a client that I've been working with for a few months from London, a couple. It's been back and forth on WhatsApps, phone calls. They were here recently. They looked at some houses. They looked at different communities. And just last week, just before Shabbat, I got a message from the husband who says, my wife still has reservations. We'll see where this is going. I'm not sure we're going to end up making Aliyah. And I wrote back to him and said, first of all, you should just know there's always a stronger partner in the relationship who is driving the Aliyah. And don't be afraid to be that strong partner.
You're a marriage counselor.
I'm telling you, don't be afraid to be that stronger partner. Somebody has to drive it. And don't give up, because this is where you belong and this is where your children belong. And I quoted something that my sister, my younger sister Tammy, often says, and that's that we don't choose Israel. Israel chooses us. And please God, when you're ready to come, you will come. You have to keep doing the work. You have to have a plan, as Hillel says. Don't give up. It's not going to happen on its own, but when the time is right, you'll be here. And I've seen that many, many times. People, they want to come, but they can't quite get here, and it doesn't happen. But all of a sudden, something clicks, and they're here in a blip.
But just to expand on that point, I'm sure I hear about it all the time. It's like, oftentimes Jews are like, when everything falls into place, I'll move to Israel. When I have a job lined up, and I've got, it's not the way it works. Because if that's your mentality, then you're going to leave the second things get uncomfortable.
You're right. You can't rely on miracles. You have to do your hishtadlut.
Right. But I'm saying there also has to be a mindset of, this is where I belong, right? If you come here because you know that this is your home, you make things work. And I'm going to say something maybe offensive, which you probably might disagree with.
Go ahead.
In 2025, emphasis, 2025, if you come to Israel and you can't make it here, you didn't want it badly enough.
Interesting.
That's what I think. I think once upon a time, it might've been a little harder. Today, if you know that you need to be here, you'll make it work.
Yeah.
And if you're going to say everything has to be ducks in a row, like I need a job, you're never going to come. You're never going to wake up one morning and say, today I'm making Aliyah and there's no challenges. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
There has to be a leap.
And similarly, I would say, people say, how do you survive here? I mean, I'm not going to lie. I should do a whole episode on this, on the cost of living. It is hard. I mean, I went shopping the other day. I did like a midweek shop, not even like the weekend shopping, and like it was 700 shekels. And I looked at my basket. I'm like, what did I just buy? And that cost of housing is very high. Things are expensive here. People ask, how do people survive? And honestly, like, it just happens. It works out.
Yeah.
If you want to be here, it does work out. I don't mean to sound holier than thou, but like 100%. Hashem has a way of helping us in different ways. And people,
you know what? I'll tell you. I'll go even one step further. Just to get philosophical on you for one second, right? What's I would say the most fundamental philosophical question in the world ever is, why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, right? Mm-hmm. Every philosopher discussed this, and I don't know if there's an answer to that question, but actually, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, and I think there is an answer. The answer is, if good things happen to good people, and every time I did a mitzvah, gold would fall out of the sky, and every time I did something bad, lightning would strike, then God can no longer reward us for our faith, because there's no need for faith. I see it. Right. It's knowledge, right? It's not faith. Mm-hmm. God's like, I gave you the Torah, right? For you to achieve that level of faith by yourself. And then I could reward you for it, right? That's how I feel about Israel. I feel like if everything was super easy, then like everyone would come. Mm-hmm. There has to be some, I mean, the Eretz Yisrael nicknames of Israel, we know that to acquire the state of Israel, you have to quote unquote suffer, not suffer, but you have to sacrifice.
Even on an individual level.
Correct. So if everything was super duper easy and there was no sacrifice, then okay, then God's like, all right, you came there because everything was perfect. Of course you're going to come there. It was Beverly Hills, right?
Right.
So there has to be, so again, everything else, all the other sacrifices that once existed, pretty much gone. Mm-hmm. Literally, from my perspective, when I tell people, it's a joke, but like when I say to people, like, what's the sacrifice you have to make today? Like, cars are more expensive. Like, maybe you can tell me if you think this is, I don't even think it's fair. I don't think it's an accurate thing to say housing is more expensive. It depends where you're coming from, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you compared Modine to New York City, then it's not more expensive, right? Is it?
No, probably not.
It depends.
But people come from Teaneck. I mean, they can sell the house for $1.5 million.
Is it fair to say housing is more expensive in Israel?
I think so. I think so.
Like if I'm going to Petah Tikva.
Yeah, Petah Tikva is expensive.
Maybe not a good example, but like, I mean, as a whole,
when
you think
I first
it's
started working in Modi'in, okay, people were selling their homes in Teaneck. They were paying off their mortgage. They bought a home in Modi'in without a mortgage and they had money left in their pocket. Right. Today, it's the opposite. You sell a house in Teaneck for $1 million, $1.5 million. Can't touch a house in Modi'in. But that's general in Modi'in. There are areas that are cheaper, but then you have to...
Right, but Modi'in's expensive, relatively speaking.
Correct.
But there are places that are affordable.
There are, but prices, housing is expensive.
You think as a whole, you could say housing is more expensive in Israel than in America as a whole? Really?
I think so.
I mean, okay, far be it for me to disagree with you, but like that seems weird to me.
I do think so. But as I discussed last week with Rabbi Fass, it's about changing your mindset. It's about making choices.
And you make it work.
And you can make it work.
And also like the food thing. I mean, yes, let's go with this. Let's say food and housing is more expensive. If you just do like literally the balance between the delta, the difference between, let's say, housing in America, housing in Israel, and then you throw in education and right. healthcare.
Sure.
You're not even close.
100%.
So like.
And then add in the meaningfulness and the weather.
That's right. That's not the reason to come here. But like, right. again, once upon a time, like, financially, you'd have to be rich to come to Israel.
Right.
It's not the case anymore. It's just not.
No, not at all. And people manage with less as well.
Right.
Okay, you eat out a lot, but most people don't.
Wait, what? You don't.
Okay, Hillel, before we wrap up, I want to ask you the question I ask all my guests. Where in Israel do you live and what drew you to that place? But before you answer, I have a little memory to share. I don't know if you remember, but many years ago, when you and Racheli were looking to buy a home, you actually came to me. You were exploring Modi'in, and I remember giving you the tour, showing you around, walking you through some properties. And then you ended up where you ended up, which you'll tell us in a minute, which, let's be honest, was a huge loss for us in Buchma Modi'in. The whole Anglo community here would have loved to have had you, but in the end, you landed where you were meant to be. And I always say buying a home in Israel is pretty much like a shidduch. It's like a matchmaking experience. You can look, explore, ask questions, do all the hishtadlot in the world, but at the end of the day, Hashem decides where you're supposed to be. He plants you in a place at a time with the people you're meant to impact and be impacted by. And you and Racheli were clearly meant to be where you are, doing the incredible work you're doing, building a community, raising your family, and being the voices of strength and clarity in a time when we all need it. So, tell us where you are.
So I live in Beit Shemesh, which is a town between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, 20 minutes from here. Modi'in. And it's a funny story, actually. So I don't know if you remember, maybe you didn't even know, I don't know, but I had a group on Facebook. Do you know about this?
No.
I had a group on Facebook called Young Couples Without Millions Looking for a Place to Live.
I vaguely remember that group. I didn't know it was yours.
Massive. I mean, it was massive. I was looking for a place to live. I didn't have millions. So I'm like, where does one live? So I started this group and it grew like exponentially. Like Kablanim, like contractors reached out. They're like, we buy the group for you. For real. Like we had meetings with contractors who, just because of the group. They're like, they wanted to make us like a whole neighbor just for us. It's
right.
Ridiculous. But on the group, in the description of the group, I wrote, you know, why I can't live here, why I can't live there. You know, Shalim's, you know, unaffordable, whatever. And then I wrote in the group, and Beit Shemesh is not relevant because of the Haredim, mm-hmm. right? Because Beit Shemesh has this name of these, you know, extremist Haredim, whatever. And I wrote that. And a friend of mine who I went to Camp Hask with 100 years ago writes me and she says, You're very wrong about Beit Shemesh. Why don't you come for Shabbos? I came for Shabbos, absolutely fell in love. And that was that.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So which neighborhood are you in?
So I live in Ofer Shemesh, Rabbi Rosner's famous Rabbi Rosner's neighborhood.
Amazing.
You know, a lot to be said about Beit Shemesh. There's Beit Shemesh, most people when they think of Beit Shemesh, they think of Ramat Beit Shemesh. We don't live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, we live in Beit Shemesh, which is quote unquote the old Beit Shemesh. And what's interesting is that there are three neighborhoods, basically, I would say 90% English-speaking, right? So there's Sheinfeld, which I would say, if I'm generalizing, right, there are some exceptions, but generalizing, I would say Sheinfeld is for mid-20s to mid-30s, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's our neighborhood, No Fash Amish, which I would say is mid-30s to mid-50s, or let's say 35 to 50. Again, I'm generalizing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the next neighborhood, which is No Fash Aviv, where my in-laws live, which is, I would say, 50 to 70, mm-hmm. right? But these three neighborhoods are all walking distance of, you know.
It's like a triangle. Like a triangle.
Kind of. One side of one neighborhood to the other side of the other neighborhood, it's like 15-minute walk, right? Right. And everyone, but literally everyone, is English-speaking. I mean, my neighborhood, famously, my rabbi, Rabbi Rosner, was the rabbi in Woodmere. And he's like, you know, said to himself, like, how am I teaching Torah all the time and teaching about it and living here in Woodmere? And he literally just picked up, brought half the neighborhood with him. So my entire neighborhood is like five townspeople. Right? Mm-hmm. Everyone, again, many of which, by the way, did not come with money. And they're living amazing lives, you know? But Beit Shemesh is something that doesn't get enough, you know, hype, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not the hype, the hip, new, whatever. But it's amazing. We love it. Yes, there are charedim. Yes, it's a thing. But it, like most things, gets a lot more press than it deserves. It's really just a small group of people. It doesn't affect my life at all, ever. At any point did it affect my life. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing city. Like, you know, beautiful. There are downsides, there are upsides, but we're very happy there.
Baruch Hashem. And Hillel, if you were to move somewhere else in the country, where would you go and why?
Is money no object?
Money's no object.
Ra'anana.
Really? Why is that?
I love Ra'anana.
Beautiful.
I love it.
What do you love about it?
First of all, the people there, I have so many amazing friends there. And like, as a tech guy, every single leading investor lives in Ra'anana. But just, I don't know, I just love it there. It's just a different energy. I can't explain it. Mm. I would say Ra'anana and Modi'in would be the next thing. I mean, yeah, and I want to live in Jerusalem. Like, obviously Jerusalem's like, you know, but I don't think that I would want to live in Jerusalem. Like, I like the feeling of coming into Jerusalem and being right. special or whatever. But yeah, if I could choose any place in Israel, it'd be Ra'anana and then Modi'in.
Love that. It's interesting because so many people want to buy in Jerusalem, but they're not looking to live here. They just want it for that, you know, that place.
Right.
But when you live here, it's a very different story. It's you're looking for community. You're looking for convenience.
100%. You know, I'm sure you guys are friends with Michael Eisenberg.
Yeah, of course.
So Michael, you know, I know him my whole life, basically. And every time I see him, he reminds me of the story. He said that, I don't know where, what point in his life or something, but he basically was having a conversation with my father. And my father said something to him along the lines of, you can own part of the rock. You can own land in Israel. He said that, I don't know if that was the reason he made Aliyah, but that like deeply impacted him.
Wow.
His view on can own part of the rock.
Love it.
Yeah, so I mean, listen, it would be a dream to own a place in Jerusalem. My parents live in Jerusalem, in Baca. It's amazing. Like, again, like we came from Queens, so we had a big house. My father was a principal of a prestigious school. Like, they were living the American dream. They would be the first to tell you they did not lower their quality of life. And I'm, again, not talking spiritually. Spiritually, obviously.
Of course.
Materialistically, they're lacking nothing. They live in an amazing neighborhood, amazing, beautiful home in Jerusalem. Like,
beautiful.
Israel's not what it used to be. It's just an amazing country.
I agree. Hillel, thank you so much for your time, your honesty, your courage, your heart. Thank you for showing up every day with clarity, conviction, and unwavering love for Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. Your voice is loud, not just because it reaches far, but because it comes from a place of deep truth. You've inspired so many to think boldly, to live more intentionally, and to ask themselves where they really belong. I've no doubt that this conversation will spark something in the hearts of our listeners. May it be a small part of bringing more Jews home. Thank you so much for being with us.
Can I say two last things?
Please.
First of all, this is a real offer. If you want to come to Israel and you're worried about a job, especially if you're in tech, talk to me. I will meet you. We will have a discussion. I will make introductions. I'll do whatever I can to break you in.
Amazing.
And then second of all, shawarma's on me.
Wow.
Of course.
That's a big one. Where'd you go for shawarma, by the way?
How long do we have? We can talk about this for hours.
Okay, we'll do another episode on that. And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here. If you've been thinking about Aliyah, wondering where you belong, or just trying to make sense of what it means to be a Jew in today's world, I hope this conversation gave you something real to hold on to. That's what Hillel does. He brings clarity, courage, and conviction. And if you're not already following him, connect with Hillel on social media. He's on Twitter or X, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube, sharing daily insights, updates, and powerful reminders of who we are and why we're here. And trust me, you'll be glad you did. If this episode moved you, please share it and join us again next week, please God, as we continue exploring what it really means to make Israel your home. Until then, Shalom Olehitrat.
Thank you for listening to On the House. A special thanks to Mordechai Gordon, our editor, who makes it all possible. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and share it with family and friends. For more insights, expert guidance, and access to listings and projects across Israel, visit buyitinisrael.com. That's BUIIT in Israel.com. Have a question or a topic you'd like Debbie to cover? You'll find contact details in the show notes. Whether you're planning Aliyah, searching for a home or a haven, or looking to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.